And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and this is the second part of my interview with University of Memphis professor Dr. Aram Gedzusian about his new book, The Men in the Moment, The Election of 1968 and the Rise of Partisan Politics in America. Today, we'll be looking at the Democratic primaries and the path up to the general election. Aram, thanks for joining us again so we can talk about the other half of the story. In our first section, we talked mostly about the Republican Party, their nominees, and the candidacy of George Wallace. Let's get on to the complete and utter mess that was the Democratic primary of 1968. We have Lyndon Baines Johnson, who is president. He's eligible to run again. Why would a man with as much of a healthy self-regard as Lyndon Baines Johnson had decide not to run for president again?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Lyndon Johnson's announcement on March 31st of 1968 that he is not going to run for re-election shocked the American political establishment and shocked the American public. LBJ was a man who loved power. The interpretation of some of his biographers, that power was what guided him, and power was everything that shaped who he was and how he became. So why would he willingly concede the presidency, right? Really willingly concede the chance to run for president again in 1968? The answer to that is manifold. By the spring of 1968, Johnson is dealing with a whole set of extraordinary pressures. Chief among them probably is the Vietnam War. Since 1965, when he started to intensify the American presence in Vietnam and when he started to bomb North Vietnam in an aggressive posture, the criticism against the war until 66, 67 had been relatively restrained to certain pockets of American society. There were politicians like William Fulbright who questioned him. There was a student anti-war movement, but it hadn't sort of entered the American mainstream yet. By early 1968, that's starting to shift. And a big reason for this is the Tet Offensive. This is a major advance by North Vietnam into South Vietnam. That starts on February 1st of 1968 at a time when the United States government is saying, look, the end of the war is near, victory is coming, and that this major attack seems to belie that. That leads to, within the White House, an inner circle starting to say, all right, we need to start thinking about ways to pursue peace and so on. Johnson even convenes a group that was informally known as the Wise Men. This was about 14 prominent government officials, former Supreme Court justices, current Supreme Court justices. It included Dean Acheson, the former Secretary of State, and military generals and so on, who convened in this sort of informal gathering with Johnson. And by March, were cautioning him that he needed to find ways to pursue peace, that he couldn't just follow the same course that he'd been following. And the American public was starting to turn against him. Now, most people weren't clamoring for just a quick exit from Vietnam. The war was confusing to many people in 68. They didn't want the United States to be there, maybe, but they also didn't want the United States to pull out and admit defeat, right? So there was this sort of sense of military and political confusion in terms of what was to be the American path in 68. For Johnson as well, he also realized that his political window had closed, so to speak. When he stepped in office to succeed John F. Kennedy in November of 1963, and by early 1964, he's pursuing an ambitious and aggressive legislative agenda that becomes known as the Great Society, right? This is a huge slate of government programs that would end up encompassing the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, that would end up including a war on poverty, environmental legislation, immigration laws that opened up immigration in the United States, hundreds of pieces of legislation. Most of those were passed in that political window leading to the election of 64, and then with the mandate that he received in 1965. He's finding an increasingly recalcitrant Congress. He's seeing an economy slowing. And so he knows that even if he were to win a second term as president, he wouldn't be as effective a president as he was in his first term. And then there's the personal dimension of Johnson as well. On the one hand, his health is starting to suffer. His wife in particular worries about his health. And he has this sort of tendency to these sort of woe is me rants. I'm not going to take this anymore. I'm just going to run for one term. And this is something that he says over and over again, even 64, 65. And nobody believes him at the time because it seems to just buck against Johnson's instincts. So all this sort of coalesces in the winter of 1968. And by March, it's something that he's been thinking about before. But in March is when he makes his decision, thinking he's really in particular thinking about his legacy. Right? He thinks that if he doesn't run for president, then he can act as something of a statesman, as a sort of be a neutral arbiter to help to bring about peace in Vietnam. He really believes that he can deliver a peace deal in Vietnam over the course of 1968 and that it will go out on a good note, and sort of this will be his great sort of sacrifice, so to speak. Part of the story of 68, of course, is that it ultimately gets derailed and Johnson continues to loom over the election in ways that even as a non-candidate, he continues to be this important factor in where the Democratic Party goes from there.
even before his announcement, people were casting around in the party, seeing if there's someone could mount a challenge to him, because mm-hmm. they were very unhappy with the way Vietnam mm-hmm. was going. And every time they would seem to ask a potential candidate, they would go, "Not me, try this other guy." Mm-hmm. And there's just a big circle of people saying, "Not me," who finally got stuck with it there at the beginning.
So it ends up as Eugene McCarthy, the senator from Minnesota. There's a group in 1967 called the Conference of Concerned Democrats, and they're basically anti-war Democrats. At the heart of them is a guy named Aller Lowenstein, who was this activist and political operative for the Democratic Party, who pushed them on civil rights and the Vietnam War. Lowenstein is searching around for a candidate. There's this pocket within the Democratic Party that is increasingly skeptical of the war. It includes people like George McGovern. It includes people like Robert F. Kennedy. Everybody is assuming that Johnson's going to run for re-election. None of them want to challenge a sitting president from their own party. A, they'll lose. B, they'll split the party. They don't see the reason to do it. No one would have expected Eugene McCarthy to emerge as the candidate as this movement was building. He was certainly against the war. He wasn't someone who people would have thought of as sort of the figure through around which a grassroots movement would coalesce. He's a very restrained figure, somewhat of an intellectual.
Let's get a poet to be president.
he wrote his own poetry. He was friends with Robert Lowell, the great poet. Very cerebral. At one point in his early life, he had considered becoming a monk. He was very much influenced by his Catholicism, and that sort of shaped his morality and ultimately his opposition to the war. But a very restrained figure. And he ultimately decided that he would run against Johnson, but do it almost like as a vessel, so to speak, for this anti-war sentiment. That he wasn't going to be a vigorous campaigner. He wasn't going to sort of arouse the emotion of people. Rather, he was going to present sort of an intellectual case for why the war should not continue, for why it was immoral, and that he would stand on sort of these sort of broad lessons, and that people could sort of then rally around him. And he didn't think that it was going to amount to anything more than almost really like a symbolic challenge to Johnson. And at that point, McCarthy figured, I'm at the stage of my career where I can do this. His bigger ambitions had seemed to have derailed by then. The first primary is, of course, the New Hampshire primary. And Johnson is not actively campaigning in the primary. He's the sitting president. He figures there's a state political machine to do that. And it would be unseemly for him to run for president anyway, or to campaign for the presidency against this upstart candidate anyway. And this is over the winter of 1968, again, when everyone assumes Johnson is still running for the presidency. But McCarthy is a terrible campaigner. He's late to go out and shake hands. He doesn't give arousing speeches. He's just not arousing any popular enthusiasm whatsoever. People think it's going to be a disaster. What saves him is this huge army of student volunteers, mostly college students, who on the weekends come up from their breaks and then end up coming for their spring break and as long as they can, and sometimes abandoning their classes at home. And they come and they volunteer for McCarthy because they really believe that the war is immoral, right? The college campuses are these hotbeds of anti-Vietnam War sentiment. They write memos. They knock on doors. They knock on just about every door in the state of New Hampshire. And they don't talk about McCarthy as a peace candidate. They mostly talk about him as a alternative to Lyndon Johnson, because there is a sort of popular frustration with Johnson at this point and about the way that Johnson has handled the war. And McCarthy ends up winning 42% of the Democratic vote. Johnson still wins the primary, or Johnson gets something like 49%. But it's a shocking result considering that Johnson is the sitting president. So that's another factor in Johnson's decision to not run. If within his party there's this challenge to his legitimacy, McCarthy's campaign is sort of bringing that to light.
But it shows he did have tone deafness and appealing to the common man, because mm-hmm. in the summer he vacations on the French Riviera.
Yeah. So McCarthy's great failing is that he's never able to translate this initial burst of support. He does very well in New Hampshire. Johnson drops out before the next primary, which is the Wisconsin primary, and McCarthy wins that one. And he's starting to develop some momentum. But even after Kennedy's assassination, McCarthy never is able to develop a genuine political movement. He's never makes that transition from being this vessel for grassroots sentiment into becoming a legitimate candidate and one who's willing to play the game of politics, so to speak. McCarthy always wants to hold to his ideals, where he's just simply standing as this representative for this movement. He's a prisoner of those ideals. That he doesn't make that transition into sort of the nitty-gritty of politics ends up at a huge cost, because he's not able to develop enough momentum within the Democratic Party to really craft a peace platform that, even if he didn't win the nomination, was still going to shape what the platform was going to be going forward into the general election. And that ends up costing American lives. It ends up prolonging the war in Vietnam, that the Democratic Party can't find a way to craft a peace plan.
Now, while McCarthy was high-minded and Catholic, mm-hmm. Bobby Kennedy was a Catholic who appealed to the working class and had everyday person support. Why did he take so long to get into the race?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, of course, Aller Lowenstein and the Conference of the Concerned Democrats, they go to Bobby Kennedy first, right? He would be their ideal candidate. He's got the Kennedy name. right? He was the attorney general under his brother, JFK, and then he's the senator from New York. He's got a national political reputation. He's certainly moving to the left in terms of his political orientation over the course of the 1960s. He's increasingly concerned with issues of racial justice, with issues of poverty. He famously visits the Mississippi Delta in 1967. He goes to apartheid South Africa to condemn racial injustice in both South Africa and in the United States. He's becoming sort of the icon of the new politics, so to speak, right? The man taking his case to the people, putting a progressive vision out there. But he doesn't initially decide to run against Johnson. He and Lyndon Johnson have this enormous personal animus toward each other, which dates back to the 1960 campaign. Bobby never wanted LBJ to be Jack Kennedy's running mate. And then LBJ always felt sort of shut out of the inner circle during the Kennedy administration. Kennedy still wanted to be Johnson's vice president in 1964, and Johnson dangled him along, but then never had any intention of picking him as his vice president. So there was this great sort of contempt on both sides for each other. But Kennedy didn't want that to be the factor that drove him into the election at first. He didn't want to split the Democratic Party. So for all those reasons, he held back. And he ends up regretting it because he sees what Eugene McCarthy is able to accomplish in New Hampshire. And he realizes that could have been him. So he hems and haws throughout that winter of 68. He says that he's definitely not going to run. And the very end of January of 1968, the next day, the Tet Offensive starts. And so he's frustrated with that. And then ultimately, in the middle of March, that's when he decides that he is going to declare for the candidacy. That's another factor that helps drive out Johnson, right? His great fear is that Bobby Kennedy is going to beat him out for the election. So that's another factor that helps him withdraw. But it also then leaves the two main candidates competing in the Democratic primaries as Eugene McCarthy and Bobby Kennedy, who are both anti-war candidates. And so they're fighting in a lot of ways for the same vote. McCarthy tends to do better in the suburbs, in the liberal suburbs. He does well with the college students who are now loyal to him. Bobby, on the other hand, tends to do well with working class voters, particularly with racial minorities. African Americans and Hispanics in large numbers tend to support Bobby. He sort of practices sort of a more physical politics, right? You know, people really want to literally touch him and grab onto him, and he has these motorcades.
He lost a shoe.
You know, people tear at his clothes, tear off his tie pins, tear off his cufflinks. He becomes a vessel in his own way for sort of this lost American innocence, right? He represents his brother on one hand and sort of an ideal of what the 60s could be to many on the left. Between the two of them, had McCarthy and Kennedy found a way to unite behind one candidate or the other, or to create some type of alliance, they could have posed a true challenge in the Democratic Party in 68. But their own rivalry, McCarthy's and Kennedy's, is key. McCarthy very much resents the Kennedys because he sees himself as the true Catholic, as the true intellectual. He says, these guys aren't as smart as me or as religious as me, and they've sort of grabbed that mantle that I thought belonged to me. For his own part, Bobby Kennedy doesn't believe in Eugene McCarthy. McCarthy had developed a reputation over the 60s as something of a lazy senator, one who didn't really sort of – wasn't in any sort of positions of leadership or driving legislative change in the 1960s. So there's this mutual distrust of each other. And of course, McCarthy resents that Kennedy jumps into the race only after he's shown that it could be successful. The assumption among some that he should just step aside for Kennedy is one that he resents as well. So they're competing against each other in the primary in Oregon in that spring. McCarthy wins, going head-to-head with Kennedy. In Indiana, Kennedy wins. Comes down to California, Kennedy edges out McCarthy in that primary in June of 68. Of course, famously, the evening of that he wins the primary, Kennedy is shot, and the next day he dies. And that leaves McCarthy in this sort of nebulous zone. On the one hand, he himself is depressed. You know, what's happening to the country? What's happened to my political rival? There's a certain sense of ennui and despair, which becomes part of McCarthy's personality at that point. But as I mentioned before, he doesn't really sort of embrace this opportunity to reshape American politics, particularly in terms of its policy toward the Vietnam War. Had he aggressively gone after those Kennedy voters and said, I'm going to help to represent you and I want to be on your side and I want to work with you and, you know, and we can sort of find the right candidate to be vice president for me as we go forward into the convention, I'm not sure that he could have captured the nomination. But what he certainly could have done is had wielded enough political power to influence the Democratic Party's position on Vietnam heading into the general election, which was a key.
Kennedy is assassinated in June, mm-hmm. and we're recording this interview on April 4th, mm-hmm. which, of course, is the anniversary of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination. Mm-hmm. How did King's assassination affect the Democratic primaries?
Mm-hmm. King's assassination had a profound effect upon American politics as a whole. At this point, of course, you know, there had been a certain amount of sort of liberal optimism after Johnson had dropped out of the race on March 31st. But the national mood, of course, shifted after April 4th with King's assassination. Every candidate had to, of course, stop campaigning and sort of show a respectful distance after King was assassinated. Meanwhile, after the assassination, there's the new round of urban violence in Chicago, for instance, endures great violence. Washington, D.C., the violence comes to within blocks of the White House. And so that ends up intensifying the calls for law and order. That ends up sort of stoking conservative fears of where the nation is headed. We tend to think now of the Martin Luther King assassination as a country in general as, of course, a great tragedy, as well we should. For many Americans in 1968, they greeted King's assassination, if not with a sense of relief, at least perhaps with a sense of this guy got what was coming to him. You know, he'd been rabble-rousing. He'd been stirring up Americans' emotions over race over this time. A large segment of the American population, if they didn't cheer King's assassination, nevertheless didn't mourn his death either. And that's a really important political factor for us to consider, and one that we should consider sort of in the moral calculus of American politics in 1968, that race was still this very sort of dangerous element to so many white voters. So when Bobby Kennedy's campaign then starts to develop over the course of spring of 1968, in a lot of ways, he becomes a vessel for a lot of African-American hopes. He sort of becomes the last best hope for King's dream to many black voters. And among the most enthusiastic people showing up at his rallies are African-Americans. And they vote for him in huge numbers. But to many white voters, that highlights Kennedy's status. You know, this popular enthusiasm for Kennedy is not something that is good. It's something that is dangerous, right? This is a guy who is going to, again, stir up the masses. So for many anxious white voters, for many conservative Americans, Bobby Kennedy is the enemy, right? He is the guy who's going to intensify the problems of America, that he's a demagogue in his own right as far as the right is concerned. So that ends up having, you know, a huge effect on sort of on the direction of American politics.
The King assassination also delays Hubert Humphrey's entry into the race. Mm-hmm. He has to be respectful mm-hmm. of that. Mm-hmm. And Humphrey serving as vice president to Johnson. Mm-hmm. There's nothing Lyndon Johnson seems to enjoy more than kicking Hubert Humphrey.
The dynamic between Lyndon Johnson as president and Hubert Humphrey as his vice president is one of the most fascinating aspects of national politics at that time, and one of the obviously a key theme in the book.
Was it just he was hazing him back how he had been treated before? Or?
To a certain degree. I mean, Humphrey had always been under Johnson's wing. This goes back to when Humphrey joined the Senate in the late 1940s, and Johnson was almost like his tutor. And he was the Senate Majority Leader, and almost like he used Humphrey as the bridge to the liberal wing. Humphrey was the sort of can-do liberal. Johnson was a man in the center who thought it was the guy who could get legislation done. But they developed this effective alliance and friendship. Humphrey runs for president in 1960. Gets trounced by Kennedy and realizes that he doesn't have the wealth, he doesn't have the resources, he doesn't have the natural constituency to ever mount a successful campaign for president from his position as a senator. So he wants to be vice president. He knows that once if he can get into the Oval Office, that could be the potential way to become president. So he really wants to become LBJ's vice presidential nominee in 1964. Lyndon Johnson is a man who knows power. He's a man who knows how to manipulate people. And he recognizes this sort of weakness in Humphrey. And he basically turns it and has Humphrey do his bidding in just about any kind of situation. And during the Democratic National Convention in 64, there's a big floor fight. Activists from Mississippi who'd organized their own, what they call the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, say, hey, we're the legitimate delegates. You know, we're interracial and we're not an all-white party. You need to seat us. And Johnson uses Humphrey as his man to sort of, if you can't deal with this crisis, you can't be my vice president, essentially is what he's saying. It was right before he's going to select Humphrey as his vice president. And he dangles him along right until the last minute. And he always talks about how the key thing that a vice president has to do is be loyal to his president. And he's always sending that message to Humphrey. And Humphrey, it's his weakness that he sort of kowtows to Johnson again and again. When the escalation in Vietnam starts in 65, Humphrey criticizes within these circles, is writing memos and saying, hey, look, this isn't the only path we can take. We don't need to escalate. This could be a political problem for you going forward. Humphrey's right on all those issues. But Johnson resents it. And in fact, he basically shuts him out of any sort of inner circle discussion on Vietnam going forward, continually manipulates him. He talks about, on one breath, he'll talk about what a great job he's doing, and the next he'll criticize him. He knows how to sort of tool with Humphrey's emotions. Humphrey's actually an exceptionally active vice president. He has a hand in all sorts of different things, and he's a man of almost as much political energy as Lyndon Johnson himself, just a whirlwind in terms of that. But his weakness, again, is that because of this need to be loyal to Johnson, or this perceived need to be loyal to Johnson, he also becomes seen as the administration's sort of cheerleader on Vietnam. Even though he's not part of that inner circle of decision makers on Vietnam, he travels there and he talks to the troops. And then he comes back and he talks to Congress about how the war is being won. And he projects this optimistic message of what's going on in Vietnam, which means that by 67, by 68, he increasingly becomes a target of the anti-war left as well, because he, more than anybody else, is out there telling Americans that we're going to win the war. So Humphrey comes out of this great liberal tradition, ends up becoming the target of liberal scorn by 1968. Once Johnson decides not to run, that opens the door for Humphrey to run, and he runs as the so-called establishment candidate for the Democratic Party heading into the convention.
you know, his reputation as the happy warrior mm-hmm. comes across as really tone deaf in this season of assassinations and mm-hmm. civic unrest, mm-hmm. and that it's hard to be a joyful person when everything's going wrong all around you.
In fact, when he announces for the candidacy at the end of April, it's just a few weeks, I think it's 3 weeks after King's assassination, he has this line in there about, I want to practice the politics of joy. And it becomes a point that everybody sort of harps on, right? How can we practice the politics of joy at this time when there's such despair, right, in Vietnam, in our cities, college students are protesting at that very moment at Columbia University and are occupying buildings. And Humphrey's sort of can-do, sunny optimism seems like it doesn't fit the times at all. And because of his stance on Vietnam, he can't win the support of the true liberals. And the establishment figures, you know, he's Johnson's guy, he's the guy we're going with, but they don't love him either. Hubert Humphrey is this man of just this great political accomplishment. I mean, he's been a senator and vice president and this great spokesman of liberal energy for so long. His run for the presidency, in a lot of ways, is his lowest moment. It shows him at his worst.
But then he stages an amazing rally over the months, mm-hmm. and he gets into the groove, mm-hmm. he finds a way to connect with people, mm-hmm. and comes very close to matching Nixon, at least in the popular vote totals.
And it's amazing to think that he does almost challenge Nixon in the general election after where he stood by August of 68 at the Democratic National Convention, right? So when he does actually win the nomination, it's because he has the support of the establishment people in the Democratic Party, and because McCarthy's not able to sort of pose a real challenge at the convention. But at that same convention, right, that's the convention where the student protesters and anti-war radicals are convening on the streets of Chicago, holding rallies, and are getting attacked by the police. And that's the nightly footage of the Democratic National Convention. It's not necessarily what's going on the floor of the convention hall, but rather what's going on in the streets of Chicago. And it makes the Democrats look like the party of disorder. On the left, they say, look, this shows the debasement of the establishment. On the right, they say, well, look at these crazy protesters, and the police are right to be doing what they're doing. And Humphrey emerges from the convention as the Democratic nominee, but of an exceptionally weakened party. Right? There's this air of defeat around the party, and he doesn't even have the full-throated support of his own president, Lyndon Johnson. Humphrey wanted to go into that convention with some kind of compromise plank on Vietnam, to say, look, we're going to make these gestures toward peace in Vietnam. And particularly that involved opening up the possibility of stopping the bombing of North Vietnam and use that as an avenue into peace discussions. Johnson is never willing to concede that political chip. He says, look, they have to stop attacking into South Vietnam, and then we'll stop bombing North Vietnam. And Humphrey, rather than sort of realize the political capital he has as the party's nominee and say, we need to pass this plank, does what Johnson wants. And Johnson continues to sort of backhandedly criticize him at various times. He doesn't really respect Humphrey as a man. You know, Johnson sort of has that sort of old-fashioned masculinity. And once a reporter asks him, what's the problem with Humphrey? And he says, he cries too much. That's it. He cries too much. Because Humphrey's this emotive, warm figure, right, who wears his emotions on his sleeve. But also because he backs down. Johnson would have respected him more if he actually stood up to his challenges. So into September of 68 is a campaign that's totally floundering. They held the convention late because they wanted it to coincide with Lyndon Johnson's birthday. But then, of course, Johnson doesn't run, so he doesn't have time to help really develop sort of a general election plan. His polling numbers are as low as in the 20% in September of 68. And he almost becomes like this icon of a certain kind of malaise. The anti-war protesters are going to Humphrey rallies. They're not going to Nixon rallies. Finally, at the end of September, his comeback begins. At the very last day of the month, he delivers a nationally televised speech in Salt Lake City, in which he goes against Johnson's policy and says, I'm open to the possibility of a bombing halt in North Vietnam to help bring about these peace concessions. And there's other parts to the plan as well. But finally, he becomes seen as a candidate who's willing to look for peace in Vietnam. And that helps to craft his comeback over the month of October. And this is at the same time that George Wallace's poll numbers are starting to drop, because there's a certain amount of fear. What if Wallace actually is able to throw this election into the House of Representatives? Labor unions are staging this big campaign against the rank and file, saying, look, Humphrey he's a Democrat who actually has been supporting labor unions, as opposed to Wallace, who's been anti-union. And Wallace is also picking Curtis LeMay as his vice president, which is a disaster. Meanwhile, Humphrey is starting to develop that momentum. He's becoming the happy warrior again. He's building up political momentum. He's got the left back on his side. He even gets a half-hearted endorsement out of Eugene McCarthy, his fellow senator from Minnesota, who is at least a little bit satisfied that he makes this anti-war statement. And then the last factor for Humphrey that becomes really key heading into Election Day is that it looks like Johnson's regime is making progress on peace talks in Vietnam.
And that would not do very well for the Republican nominee, Richard Nixon. And Haldeman's diary recently gave more credence to the assertions that Nixon helped scuttle those peace talks.
Mm-hmm. So what do we know about the Richard Nixon and the peace talks going on in Vietnam in 68? Well, we know for certain that he's working through a woman named Anna Chino, part of what was known as the China lobby, sort of an anti-communist lobby within Washington, D.C. circles, and that she was sort of serving as a go-between between the South Vietnamese president, Thieu, and the Republican Party. And she was communicating often through John Mitchell, who was Nixon's campaign advisor. And so she was in close contact with the South Vietnamese ambassador and sort of keeping them updated as she learned things. Meanwhile, in Paris, there are peace talks going on that start soon after Johnson's announcement. By that summer, the peace talks begin. They derail for a while, but then there's a certain developing momentum for them by October of 68. The basic plan is that North Vietnam and South Vietnam will be part of these discussions, but the communist forces within South Vietnam will have a place at the table but won't be diplomatically recognized. And so they're working out all of the ways in which they can work toward a ceasefire. And it seems like there's a lot of progress being made. We also know that Henry Kissinger, who originally served as an advisor to Nelson Rockefeller, the Republican governor from New York, once Nixon became the nominee, he was, you know, had access to the Paris peace talks and was getting information to Nixon that way as well. He wants to be part of the Nixon administration. So what Nixon fears is that there'll be a peace deal before the election. Then the Democrats will become the party of peace, and that will swing voters over to the Democrats on sort of the bread and butter pocket issues, right? Democrats support the working people, and their government programs have been successful in helping most Americans, and that voters will flock to the Democratic Party and call them the party of peace. Nixon's political strategy throughout 68 has been to be as vague on Vietnam as possible, right? To not make any promises one way or the other, to not be seen as either a candidate of peace or as a candidate of an aggressive posture. Basically, to be as neutral on the issue as possible, because he realizes that's in his political favor. As long as he's just seen as an alternative to Lyndon Johnson, that's what he wants. By the time we get to October and into early November, Johnson announces that there's going to be a ceasefire about a week before the election is supposed to be held. And then the South Vietnamese Prime Minister, Nguyen Van Thieu, rejects it. He says the next day, no, we are not going to go to Paris. So what happened, right? Clearly, the South Vietnamese president believes that they can get a better deal under a Republican president like Richard Nixon. So the question then becomes, did the Nixon administration communicate this to South Vietnam? Because if they did so, that's technically treason. Under the Logan Act, which was passed in 1799, any citizen interfering with diplomatic negotiations is committing treason. There is no one single piece of evidence that shows that Richard Nixon knew about this diplomatic back channel and exploited it. But there's lots of evidence that shows that he was around it, right? John Mitchell, his campaign manager, was clearly involved in it in a very direct sort of way. And you mentioned the diary of H.R. Haldeman, who was one of Nixon's closest advisors. This was recently discovered by a Nixon biographer named John Farrell, that in his diary, Haldeman's taking notes, and it's about a week before the election, and says, keep Anna Chino working on SVN, which stands for South Vietnam. Anything RN can do about it, anything Richard Nixon can do about it, anything you can do to monkey wrench it, let him know. So basically, like, it suggests that it's another step that shows that Nixon was at least involved in what was going on. But by Election Day, in early November of 68, in general among the American voters, there's confusion about what's going on in Vietnam, right? On the one hand, there were these announcements of these peace talks, and then South Vietnam is saying they're going to back out of them. So there is no victory that Johnson can point to that would have helped Humphrey. There's also some question on the Democratic side. Should Johnson or Humphrey have exposed Nixon's machinations prior to the election? Humphrey would later express some regrets about not having done so and wishing he'd done so. But Humphrey didn't have all the information. Johnson had all the information from the FBI, by the CIA, by the National Security Administration, some of which was illegal surveillance against the Republican Party. So he couldn't bring it up either.
Also, they didn't want to expose the methods on how they spy on embassies that are out there in Washington
exactly.
as well.
So the diplomatic intrigue on all sides, right, was pretty thick. What that ultimately meant for the election was that there was just a more general sense of confusion on Vietnam as much as anything else in terms of the peace process.
And which really does mirror the 2016 election, where we had evidence of Russian tampering and Mitch McConnell told President Obama not to release the information.
Exactly. So there's the echoes between 1968 and 2016. I was writing the bulk of the book in the midst of the 2016 election and into early 2017. The echoes were often quite eerie, right? These accusations of foreign interference into our elections. Donald Trump often echoed the rhetoric of conservative candidates from 68. He often used Nixon's term of law and order, a term that became associated with Nixon particularly by 72, but he's already starting to find the language for it in 68, is this notion of the silent majority. The average American voter who resents all these challenges to the American order, who's patriotic, who believes in law and order, particularly coded toward white voters. Trump uses the term silent majority. But he also uses a lot of the tactics of George Wallace. His rallies in many ways mirror those of Wallace in terms of the sort of this threat of violence, you know, use of the protests against the candidate as a political tool itself, right, so that people would shut that person down. And they welcome that sort of confrontational atmosphere. You might remember heading into the election day in 2016, Trump talked often about how the election would be rigged against him, right? Wallace used the exact same terms. He said, those polls are rigged. I have the support of the American people. Right? This is what Wallace did effectively in 68 was he sort of channeled a version of this notion of populism, right? And by populism, it's sort of saying that I'm the candidate who represents the popular will against these big interests, these elite interests, whether that's corporations or whether that's government institutions or whatever. Populism is a tool in American politics dating back to the late 19th century in one form or another. It had been used mostly by the left up until the 60s. What Wallace does effectively is he channels it toward the right. And that's what Trump does, of course, to a much greater purpose in 2016.
Could you tell us a little bit about Richard Hofstadter's paranoid style of American politics?
Right. So it's an essay that becomes a book by the Columbia historian named Richard Hofstadter in the early 1960s called The Paranoid Style in American Politics. And it's basically built around the same idea, the idea that there's this trend, this tradition in American politics to sort of focus on these outsiders, on these elites. That becomes a key political tool, to be paranoid toward unnamed forces, unseen forces that are out to get you, that are going to hurt the working man. That's the political style that Wallace practices in 68.
Mm-hmm. A couple of years ago, Lawrence O'Donnell came out with a book called Playing with Fire that also addresses the 1968 election. Mm-hmm. That is aimed more at a general audience. How does historiography differ from a more general style that took with that book?
You know, I like Lawrence O'Donnell's book. I think it's a fine narrative history. I think what he does in some ways is mirror what many journalistic accounts of the 68 election do, which is focus especially on the fracture of the Democratic Party. About 80% of that book is geared toward the Democrats. I think the story of the 1960s, right, is one that has been especially told by the baby boomer generation and tends to be told from the perspective of the left, right, in terms of the liberal fracture, in terms of radical action and so on. I think what many academic historians are uncovering, and what I'm trying to do is with this book, is try to take a lot of those insights and channel it into this accessible, short narrative history that anyone can grab, is to show what was going on the left, but also to show what was going on the right. In a lot of ways, the story of the 1960s, the key grassroots movements are not just among civil rights activists or anti-war protesters, but among those Orange County suburbanites and those people in suburban Atlanta who are protesting school busing and who are rallying around Barry Goldwater and then Ronald Reagan. Conservatives are running their own grassroots movements. And those are the ones that tend to have a more lasting impact on American politics going forward. We entered into a more conservative era in American politics post-1968.
The success of the Southern strategy.
The success of what some have called the Southern strategy, what a lot of academic historians say, it's not just a Southern strategy, it's a suburban strategy. The same things that work in Cobb County, Georgia, are also working in suburban Philadelphia and are working in Cicero, Illinois and all throughout the country, right? That there's connections in terms of those kinds of politics. That there's a lot of voters who vote their anxieties, who vote their restraint, who have achieved a level of prosperity and want to hold on to that, and are thus shifting away from the politics of the 50s and 60s in that regard.
Well, Aaron, what else are you working on now?
You know, it was a really interesting book for me to write in the sense that it was a little bit different than some of what I'd written about before. Most of my earlier work was about, in some way or another, about the civil rights era and African-American history. I'd written a book about Bill Russell, the basketball player, a book about Sidney Poitier, the actor. And my most recent book before this one was about the civil rights march called the Meredith March Against Fear that occurred in 1966. So writing just sort of formal politics, high politics story was a departure for me and one that I really enjoyed as kind of almost like a vacation from from the other kind of writing I'd done. At the same time, I thought it was intimately connected to those same themes, right? It's the same time period. Race is a core theme running through the book, of course. But in this case, I'm looking at these elite white men on both sides of the political story. And to be writing that in the midst of the 2016 election, right, was really a fascinating dynamic for me. And it made it feel really sort of real and tangible in ways that I wasn't even anticipating. As I'd begun the research. What's next? I have a few little projects. I agreed to work with the Pink Palace on an exhibit next year that's going to celebrate 100 years of Tiger basketball. So in March of 2020, we should have an exhibit that celebrates Tiger basketball, but also thinks about what basketball has meant to the city of Memphis and what stories we can tell about ourselves as a city that way. The other project that I'm working on is a big departure for me, and that is that I'm working with an illustrator on a comic book about James Meredith, the man who integrated the University of Mississippi in 1962. I know a lot about the James Meredith story from the civil rights book that I wrote. He was the one who started the March Against Fear in 1966. So this is an entirely new challenge for me. I didn't even really read comic books as a kid and don't read many graphic novels now at all. But I know the story and I know James Meredith and I have a good grasp on him. So I'm trying to figure out a way to make this a visual story that can appeal to young audiences and then work with this illustrator to try to do so.
Be a good follow-up to the March series from John L. Lewis.
Yeah, and we're very much inspired by the March series, those three graphic novels that tell the story of John Lewis's life and career. I think that showcased to a lot of publishers, right, that there's a young audience out there that can learn the civil rights story that isn't necessarily going to read an academic text on the issue.
Mm. And as you pointed out, you know, we had these elite white men in the story of the men in the moment. Mm-hmm. And I looked at the title and I said, well, you know, when they write about the 2020 election somewhere in the future, they're going to have to find another alliteration to go along with the people and the problem. I don't know.
It's interesting. You know, this is definitely a story in a lot of ways about men and about manhood. All of them in different ways talk about manhood in one respect or another. And it's right before the women's movement is really starting to have a major influence on American politics. For instance, the National Organization of Women puts out a platform and only two candidates even address it. And they're both the candidates of the left. This is Bobby Kennedy and Eugene McCarthy. Women's issues are still sort of getting buried in 68 in a way that they're about, immediate aftermath of this election, they're about to sort of explode into the forefront. You know, gender politics becomes such a key to both the Democrat and Republican identity by the 1970s. In 68, it's just below the surface. So this is really sort of the last election in some respects, which is so male-centered in that way, right? And as you say, like in our modern political environment, you can't talk about it in those terms anymore. It would be foolish to do so. Yeah.
Well, Aram, I want to thank you so much for coming by today. It has been a real pleasure.
It's my pleasure, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Aram Gudsousian is the author of The Men in the Moment, The Election of 1968 and the Rise of Partisan Politics in America, which is published by the University of North Carolina Press. I'm Stephen Ussery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.